Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needle players.
I like how you've shortened it.
That's yeah, I took one. It right down, didn't I? Right down to the quick and dirty there. Needle players,
just,
yes.
Just the essence of it. Excellent.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And our guest this week, the Scarlet House, Tanya Brockmeyer. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, how are you?
We are super, I think. I am.
I hope you don't mind if I correct you right off the bat, but it's actually Tanya.
Tanya.
My mom. Yep, it's Tanya, not Tanya. My mom would be a little put out if I didn't correct you.
Okay.
Well, thank you for doing that.
All right. There we have it. Tanya.
Yes.
That'll teach me to forget to ask beforehand. So, okay, got it.
So, if it makes you feel any better, Gary has a long, years-long reputation of mispronouncing people's names. So welcome to the club.
Yeah, see, it just makes you normal.
Well, anything that helps me become more normal works for me.
Yep. And Tanya, I have it. Tanya, reproduction samplers, and then you design your own samplers.
Yes, I do both.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, you're out there in Chandler, Arizona. There's a place out there called The Attic. They do something with samplers. You ever hear of it?
I think I've heard of it a time or two. Okay. Maybe I've even walked in the door once in a while.
Okay, just checking. I didn't want you to miss out, you know.
Yes, actually, I'm very familiar with it. I actually even worked there for a couple of years in the early 2004, 2005. So I worked there. So that was a really good experience to get exposed to all the samplers. I mean, that's kind of where the sampler, infatuation, I think, actually began.
Yeah, was it's hard to miss in that shot.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So that must have been a fun experience then to be able to work there and just literally be immersed in samplers. I mean, of all kinds. So you work on the floor. Did you teach? What did you do at the shop? A little bit of everything?
Oh, no. Just worked on the floor, filled orders, waited on customers, put, supplies away, kitted up projects for people for mail orders and things like that. There was no teaching or anything like that involved. It was just mostly, sales type. Work, but it was a great experience to learn all the different types of linen and fibers. I mean, it was absolutely eye-opening because I was familiar with the basics, just kind of starting to get into like 32 count linen shortly before that, and boy, it didn't take long before I was stitching with silk and on 40 count linen, and when you're exposed to it, you just can't stop.
Yeah, Gene will hold a gun to your head if you stitch on anything less than 30 count.
Oh, exactly. And, her in that 52, 60, I try it, but I can do it, but it wears my eyes out. Oh. It really makes them terribly tired, so I'll leave that to her.
Yeah, she loves that cloth. That's no doubt about that.
Yes, exactly.
So I always think working in a shop like that you get a real quick trial by fire helping out customers in terms of issues that they're having, help that they need. It must not take long before you've experienced an awful lot.
Well, exactly. And when you're a newbie, you come in and it does take a while to learn, where all the different suppliers, where the supplies come from. And, it's just a learning as you go kind of job. I always seem to enjoy working with the customers that wanted to come in and, they had a pattern, but they didn't like the colors necessarily that they were called for. So they'd want to change things out. And that was always kind of my favorite thing because I'm all about color and I'm very picky about colors. So that was probably my favorite part as far as helping customers, with that sort of thing.
Yeah. Seems like fun to me. Seems like a great time.
Well, I can honestly say, I think I owe Jean more money at the end of the week than what she actually paid me.
That's the problem with that, right?
So exactly.
Yeah.
But it's a great way to, you know, build your supplies up for sure.
Go ahead, Gary.
No, go ahead. That's all right.
No, I was going to say, I think that that service of walking people through changing colors is probably that, and maybe choosing fabrics is probably one of the more fundamental things that people are afraid of, because, you know, you can pick a fabric if somebody, you know, everyone loves the please tell me what to do. So yes. I'm going to use this thread. I'm going to use this fabric. But as soon as you decide, you know, I don't like these colors, I'm going to choose something else. Unless you have that confidence of working with color, and I've met people who do, and I am not that person. So I really appreciate and admire that in other people, the ability to just to choose colors that just somehow seem to work together, that I look at them and I say, I never in a million years would have put those colors together. So right. So being able to have somebody that they can lean on and say, I'm kind of thinking in the blue range and I like this, what goes with it, and having somebody be able to choose those things, that's tremendous. And then, you know, people will gain confidence after they've seen it done a bunch of times. But I think that's one of the more difficult things to do, because it requires a great deal of subjectivity, I think.
Well, I'm always surprised when I get an email from someone that says, well, you know, you've charted something to use this color, but it doesn't really show up on my linen. You know, what can I do, or can I change it? And I'm like, well, yeah, you can change it, because yeah. it's your piece that you're going to do, and just choose a color that pleases you. I don't know. I guess I've always done that with other people's designs that I've stitched. And I thought, well, if I don't like this color, I'll just choose one that I do like. And mm-hmm. and maybe that's easy for me to say. I do have an art background. I studied yeah. art. I took every art class available in high school and in college. And so color is just kind of my thing. It's, you know, the thing I probably enjoy the most as far as choosing, you know, what I want to use.
Okay, so since working at the Attic was not to make money, what draws you to that? I mean, you were obviously stitching beforehand, and it was.
I have stitched. I picked up my first needle probably in home ec in seventh grade. I don't know if you remember something called chicken scratch, where you
yep.
do the little X's on a gingham fabric, and we made aprons. And I think when I made my very first X, I was just hooked. I knew this was what I needed to do. And I literally haven't put my needle down since. So it's just been nonstop. I really didn't start with cross stitch until I was about 17, I guess. I picked up a little kit somewhere, and it was just on 14 count Aida, and it had the supplies or the thread with it. And I just taught myself how to do it and thought, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing ever. And, you know, I just, like I said, I've never stopped since that day.
Yeah. That's so it, that home economics thing. Cause I don't remember really very many at all of the teachers I had through school, but Miss Sakamoto in home ec is one that, cause you know, it was for me, it was, you know, all science and math and stuff. And so this home econ thing was this completely different class. And we had so much fun in there, baking and sewing and things, and guys against the girls, you know, who can do it the best. And, you know, and you look at that doesn't exist anymore today in school. And I look at what I took out of there. You know, I was no longer afraid to be in the kitchen. A mm-hmm. needle and thread and a sewing machine didn't scare me. You know, all those fundamentals that you pick up, and they aren't available anymore. And, you know, and then that's the one teacher I remember. And for you, it was, you know, your first time with a needle and thread. And
Right. I know. It's very sad that has stopped being taught in school, because I don't know. It's just been such a big, important part of my life that I can't imagine. Now, I will say that we had home ec on one semester, and then I don't know, the other half was cooking.
It's
all in the kitchen kind of thing. And I hated that part. I wanted to get back to the, you know, the sewing and that kind of thing. I didn't want to learn about cooking at all. So, but yeah,
I think it's a little bit of a, it might be a district thing too, because so my son is in ninth grade now, and eighth grade they did home and, well, they call it home and careers now. So they spend less time on the, you know, sewing machine and the hand work type things, and more about, you know, what is it you want to do with your life and those sorts of discussions. But mm-hmm. I have in front of me a stitched duck that he made that, you know, they had to all cut out fabric and stitch by hand. And he now does more cooking than I do. And if I dare to cook eggs, he just looks at me and sighs and says, please don't ever do that to me again. Yes. It's the, you know, hey, do you want me to make you some eggs? Nah, I got it. I'll do it. Thanks. No. Wow. For that. He's like, because you don't do it right. So there is that. So they teach your children to tell you how to do things.
Well, sure.
But mm-hmm. but it is. In fact, my sister-in-law was a home and careers teacher. And it's funny, actually, because she self-admittedly, she had a doctorate in education, and she, I'm not even sure how she ended up in this particular field, because by her own admission, she was a terrible cook and she couldn't sew. So for her, and I'm not going to disagree, that was all true. For her, it was all about, you know, she did some basics of those things, but it was more about self-exploration with the kids. So what is it that you like to do? How do you go about, you know, more sort of daily skills of life sort of thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of cooking and a little bit of sewing, but also how do you figure out what do you want to be when you grow up and things like that. So I think the curriculum is still there, at least in New York State it is. It's just changed a little bit to open it up to other things. Then the opposite is shop and machine shop, and we all still have to do that too, although they call it tech now because, you know, shop is, I guess, the retro word.
I would have liked taking shop as well. I kind of like, you know, cutting up wood and putting it together and things like that.
We had to do half a year of each. None of us had a choice. So, yep, we learned, what did we make? Bookshelves and engraved things and all kinds of stuff. And I think, you know, what it does is it teaches you. It's like Gary said, you just said exactly the thing. You're not afraid of things. Because, all right, I've worked with a table saw before, so I kind of know what to do. And I've worked with a sewing machine, so I have a general idea of what that thing is and what it can do. So, if anything else, it's just exposure, especially if you don't have a parent who does those things.
Well, I think, you know, skills like that were taught more by parents, obviously, back in the, you know, older days, because out of necessity they had to have help around the farm or the kitchen or wherever, and so the kids had to learn how to do that stuff. Right. Whereas now, I, you know, kids don't want to do anything like that. Probably to help. At least mine didn't.
So did you keep stitching once you got hooked? You just kept going through high school and college?
I did. I just never, you know, and I stitched. I remember listening to one of your podcasts with someone, and you talked about, I think it was you who talked about stitching all the country designs you could get your hands on, and, you know, just anything that was out there. That's kind of what I started doing. I was kind of into that cows and, you know, just that style. And then, you know, it did progress, obviously, to samplers once I discovered those. And I've always been very interested. I love antiques of all kinds. I've had them. I've collected them my entire life. So it just fits in with the stuff that I like. And I've often joked that I was born, you know, a century or two too late, because the things that I really love are the old, you know, just old vintage type things. So. Wow. But, yep, I have never stopped since that day.
Do you remember your first reproduction sampler? Because we just talked this a little bit ago. Christine got one for her birthday. So we're very interested in your first.
The first one. Oh, gee.
Uh-oh.
Actually, yeah, you're putting me on the spot. I've stitched some that weren't actual. They were samplers styled like that, but not actually a repro. I'm sure it was something from the Scarlet Letter. She has great reproduction samplers, and I've stitched several of those. But right off the top of my head, I can't remember what my very first one was. I have about, I don't know, more than 50 hanging on my wall. So I just don't remember which my first one, honestly, was.
That's all right. Yeah, that picture you sent, we'll put it up with the podcast, the picture you sent of all the samplers on your wall. That's one impressive wall, I'll tell you.
Well, those are just the samplers that I've stitched of other designers that, mm-hmm. Through the years that I have in my living room. And then I keep my reproductions, the antiques are in my office. And, of course, my own reproductions and models all hang at the attic. That's their home. I know you've been there and seen them there. So,
Yeah, we caught a few in the video, I think, didn't we?
Yes, you did. You did. Yeah. I'm on the corner, and I keep jokingly telling Jean she's going to have to enclose that one little section and make a bigger wall. Otherwise, I'm going to have to stop because I'm running out of room there.
That was such a fun tour to go through and see all those samplers in that shop. That's an excellent little museum right there.
It is. And there are so many people I read on Facebook and places all the time that say, that's in my bucket list to get there. And, it's a destination for sure. People that want to, come out and just see it because you just can't imagine it. I mean, I've been to some very nice shops, but not with that many of that type of samplers hanging in the walls. I mean, there's just so many to look at. You have to go several times, and then you maybe not see it all then.
Is there another shop that is anywhere near that in terms of samplers that you've encountered?
You mean across the country?
Anywhere for that matter.
Well, not that I've personally been to. I mean, there are certain shops that carry some. I know have some of mine in there. But I think that's just really that's just the attic's speciality, I guess. So they have more than anybody, I believe. I've never heard or seen a shop that has that many samplers.
Yeah, I haven't either. So what then?
I was going to say, you would think, so it's a kind of a risky business endeavor when you think about it, because needlework itself is a little bit of a niche hobby. And then to, limit it to cross stitch, okay, now you're limiting it more. And now it's just, focusing on samplers. It is a little risky because you're limiting the number of people that it would appeal to. But it sounds like what they've done successfully is they've done it so well that, like you said, it becomes a destination. So it's not just their local needlework shop. It's everyone's sampler shop.
Exactly. I mean, there's certainly something there for everyone, even though the focus is on samplers. I mean, the people that love samplers, truly love samplers, I mean, they're a really dedicated group. And they really, I mean, I have some people that probably only stitch my reproductions. And then I have others that just like to stitch my original designs. They're just, that's samplers just, is not their thing. And I'm fine with that. I try to do something for everyone. And honestly, I don't always stitch a great big sampler, even if I were just doing it for my own personal pleasure or whatever. I just, I stitch whatever I just enjoy. I'm enjoying at the moment, I guess. So I try to do a little of both.
Were you designing, doing design work while you were working there, or did you break off to start the Scarlet House? And where does that Scarlet House name come from?
Oh, no, I never even had any inclination or desire or idea that I would ever design. I left there in 2005 and went to work at an accounting job.
How boring.
Exactly. And I worked there for a while, and it just, I was just helping out the owners of the business. And And I just came home one day and said to my husband, you know, I don't really want to do this. I really want to try designing. And he looked at me and he said, well, do you think anybody would buy anything? And I said, well, I don't know. I hope, I think, you know, maybe. And so I just went about designing two little pieces. And Gene actually bought, I think, 6 charts of each. And I thought, wow, I've actually sold something. And it just progressed from there. And it didn't take long until I thought, well, okay, I also want to, you know, maybe do a sampler now and then. So I told the biggest lie I've ever told. I found a sampler that I wanted to purchase. And I told my husband, if you just let me buy this one sampler, I promise.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Yes, exactly. I said, I'll never need another one. I just want one for my wall, just, you know, because it's an antique and whatnot. And well, I now have 54 of them. So I guess I didn't keep my word.
It was a lie at the time. You believed it. So it wasn't an untruth. It just was no longer a relevant truth after a while. There's a big difference there.
I just kind of stretched it a little bit. But the Scarlet House name actually came about because I have a dog named Scarlet. She's the smallest of the Boston Terriers. And I used to have a blog called The Scarlet House, kind of partly for her name and partly because red is my favorite color. And on this blog, I mostly showed stitching that I was doing. And I don't know. And then when I started designing, it just kind of seemed like the natural. I had followers on my blog, so it just was a natural carryover, I guess, to name it The Scarlet House. And so when I designed my logo, it's of course a red house, red brick house that I took off of. I modified it slightly off of my first antique reproduction called Sarah Elizabeth Brooks, the one that I said I would only need one of. And I
well played, I actually, by the way, very well
yes,
played.
Yes, exactly. And I actually stitched little Boston Terriers. One on the roof, which is Scarlet. She's the top dog or CEO of the Scarlet House. And then the other two, we only had 3 at the time, were on the, I don't know, the lower roofs, I guess. So that just kind of became my logo. And, you know, the dogs are such a big part of my life that it was only natural that, you know, they be included in the name and the business. So that's it.
That's fun. So. That's fun.
So nothing more exciting than that.
Take us through when you buy a sampler, an original, an antique one. Take us through your process of reproducing that. I'm curious about how what's the actual mechanics of taking a sampler and getting it charted so that others can stitch it.
Well, mainly it's just, you know, getting a magnifying glass or very good. Some of the work is done on extremely fine linen, like 48 count. And sometimes it's even weave, which makes it a little bit harder to see. And I just basically use a very good light and a magnifying glass. And I use a software called Pattern Maker Pro, which most designers that I know use. And you just sit down at the computer and you just, it looks like graph paper on your screen. And you just start counting, you know, replicating the stitches on the sampler onto your screen. I do always design in DMC because that has the biggest range of colors. But I don't ever stitch anything, any of my models. I usually design in DMC and then I figure out what type of linen I want to use. Then I start choosing the colors that I want to use, usually silk for samplers and cotton overdyes, typically for like an original design. So that's kind of how you go about it. And, you know, it's just painstakingly sitting there and you know, replicating it on the computer to get it done.
So no secret, no mystery, no nothing. It's just pure grunt work, just getting that all, counting every X and every square then.
Right. And sometimes, you know, it's very frustrating because the borders are sometimes really wonky and they don't match. And you have to remember that these young girls were stitching, you know, either by candlelight or maybe in some, you know, natural light, but their conditions were nothing like what we have today. So it's a wonder that, you know, they can ever actually have an accurate, you know, motif or whatnot. But it's just, you know, getting it charted, and then I choose my supplies, and then I stitch the model, and then, you know, do the packaging and the photographs and all that sort of thing. I mean, it's, I often said it's kind of like, you know, waiting 9 months to have a baby, and, you know, and then once you're ready to release it, it's like, oh, here it is, you know, you present it. And so it's just kind of, you know, it's a long process, but it's definitely enjoyable.
What kinds of fabrics do you find that the antiques are stitched on? What range of fabrics?
Oh my, they can be anything from some of mine are very coarse. I can't even really tell you exactly what they are, but they're just like a very loose, you know, kind of coarse, rough weave, some of the more primitive ones, and then I have some that are stitched on very, very fine, almost gauze-like type linen. It's a whole variety. It's just like they stitched on whatever they had, you know, available. I can't honestly answer. That would be something more for a sampler expert, you know, as to what fabrics were available. I don't know. I just know that what I have is quite varied. So.
Do you how do you determine the colors? Is that front, back, not sure, make your best guess? How does that all get done? Or at some times do you say, actually, this color would look better with this sampler, so that's what I'm going to chart out.
Well, I try to be true to the original. If the back, some of mine are framed, and they're framed fairly well, even, you know, I don't know if they're all the original frames or whether they've been reframed along the way, but some I hesitate to take out of the frame, so I just chart them directly from the front colors, because some actually are very still very vivid. I try to be true to the sampler, and not, you know, totally redo it. But typically the samplers, the colors on the back, I find are just a little bit too bright for my taste. I kind of tend to lean more towards the more muted or faded colors on the front. And once you're using new thread, you're kind of somewhere in the middle anyway. Do you know what I mean? They're not maybe as dull or as bright as the back. So it kind of works out. But I do try to, you know, to keep consistent with what the antique originally was.
Yeah, see, that's the part about these I think that intrigues me the most is determining the colors. And yeah, so many, 100, 150 years, 200 years ago, and for you to say that the actual colors on the back are almost too bright for you, is fascinating to me because I just don't have the picture in my head that they would have brightly colored threads available. And at that time, and most of what we see are fairly muted, and it so it, it, that's why I asked about it, is just how do you determine that, and how do you make you, I mean, it has to be a lot of judgment calls, I would think, in terms of what actual colors you spec.
Well, exactly. And I do probably tend to have favorite colors. You know, I mean, green isn't always just green. I mean, there's many, many, many shades of green, but I probably tend to go to, I don't know. I try not to use the same color green all the time, but I suppose I do have some favorites. I do have a sampler from 1802 called Mary Rowe. The colors, I've never taken it out of the frame, but the colors on the front are so bright, hot pink and turquoise. It's absolutely amazing from 1802 that these colors have withstood, you know, fading. It must have been in a, you know, kept fairly well because it, there's just no fading to it at all. So that was kind of fun. I actually reproduced that one using the same colors as on the front because I just, how could you not, you know?
Yeah.
It was fun.
And so. Really, how much of the muted colors that we see are merely just an artifact of the aging process?
Right,
you know,
right.
It may be that they were all stitched, you know, or many were stitched using bright colors, and it's just that we are accustomed to seeing them muted because the fabric itself is discolored over time and the threads have faded. So, like, to Gary's point, our eye is used to seeing, you know, these sort of washed out kinds of things, but that's just because they're old, you know. If you went back to the time, that people might have thought that those looked very strange because they were all stitching in bright colors, right?
Well, they used the, you know, what the plants and dyes and whatnot that they had available to them. And, I wish I knew more about how they came about some of the colors because it's very interesting, to see the front and then see the back. And you'd sometimes wonder, what was she thinking, you know, with this bright purple flower? But, most of these young girls were so young that, you know, I often wonder, you know, were they just, you know, did they like color? Did they want, you know, things to be a certain way? Or I don't know. It's just kind of fun to imagine what they might be thinking while they're actually stitching those. So. Yeah.
The more that I have seen of samplers and more charts that I've purchased, it still amazes me what these little kids did with a needle and thread. I mean, it just for a lot of us adults, reproducing that is plenty of a challenge. And it was just these little girls, like you said, by candlelight, producing these things, and we look at them and we're impressed by them. And they're just kids' work, and it's we think, at least I do, you know, that many years ago, that level of sophistication, how could that possibly be? And it's just really, that's the one part about it that just sticks with me all the time. Is every time for me, it's just a wow, some little girl did that.
I know. I'm always absolutely blown away by that too. I have a few samplers that are stitched by 7-year-olds, and I have a 6-year-old granddaughter that I've tried to teach how to stitch, and well, it's going to take a little bit to get her, you know, up to speed, but and I hope to, you know, I have 5 granddaughters, so I'm hoping that eventually they'll all, you know, take up a needle, but so far it hasn't quite happened yet, but I have hope.
So I think, but yes, part of that too is, you know, what do our children do all day? You know, they have other recreational things to do that are appealing to them, that are contemporary and that are things that their kids, their friends are doing. Whereas back then, there's no TV, there's no PlayStation, there's no phone, there's no, I'm going to call my friend on the phone. So, you know, the number of things that were available for recreation was different. So you can imagine how a young girl would, you know, she's not running around and doing the things that our kids are doing that
right,
seem much
right.
more, you know, if you took that girl and put her here, I don't know that she would be as good a stitcher because there'd be way more interesting things to do. You know, I that's
right.
part of it as well.
Well, I've often wondered, oh my gosh, you know, is this little girl, is she just sitting here hating every minute of this, or is she enjoying it? You know, is she just making that stitch tension so tight because she just wants to be done with it, or, you know, what? So it's kind of fun to, you know, imagine what they were thinking while they were sitting there, with, you know, whether they were forced to do it or whether they enjoyed it.
Yeah,
so.
That's a good point.
Yeah, instrument or piano practice, you know, you did, it's a half hour, we're setting the timer, you have to stitch for a half an hour and we're setting the timer.
And most people that I know, they would love to have somebody tell them to go sit down and stitch.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
you bet.
So
what, when it comes to buying an original, what draws you to it? Are there motifs that if you see that, you have to have that sampler, or is each one just kind of a sensory connection for you?
Oh, definitely kind of a connection. I am certain elements that I'm totally drawn to. The color red, obviously, especially red houses. I kind of have a thing for that. And I love samplers with dogs, birds, sheep, cows. I really tend to go more towards the pastoral type samplers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. It just, they seem so peaceful to me. I'm a self-professed border hater. I don't hate borders, but I don't enjoy stitching them necessarily. I unless they're really unusual, then that sometimes attracts me. But after I've stitched the same motif, you know, two or three times, I'm kind of ready to move on to something else. But I definitely have, I've been told that people can kind of tell if it's a Scarlet House sampler now, because I must be buying similar ones, or ones that all have a similar look to them. So, but I don't know, I guess it's just the overall composition and, you know, just how it attracts me when I look at it initially.
You and Nicola need to team up. She'll stitch your borders all day long. So
yeah, I was going to say.
Maybe I'll take a few to Nashville and hand them off to her.
Here, stitch these, Nicola.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I do it, but it's not my favorite thing. I make myself do a little of the border before I can move into the content, and then I have to do a little bit more of the border. You know, I never do the border all at once and then fill in. I've never done it that way. So
borders are like background stitching for needle pointers. You do a little at a time just to ease the pain.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm working on a sampler now that I'm getting ready for market that has, it's a great sampler, but it has this huge lawn and it has several sheep and a giant dog in it. Well, once I got through the sheep and the dog, then I'm left with this massive amount of grass to stitch. And oh my gosh, I didn't think I was ever going to finish it, but I did. It's like, okay, need to put something else in here.
Oh. And you stitch all your own models, right? Oh, go ahead, Chrissy.
I was just going to say, that's what, you know, I find, like, you know, doing the things that I'm doing now, I think maybe I think I'm the same way. You just get bored of stitching the same thing. So I know that, you know, okay, I'm supposed to stitch this, and then this is the next thing. And I do a little bit of one thing, and then I get excited by the next thing that looks interesting. So I put that first thing down, and then, yeah, I end up jumping all over the piece, which sometimes I think is not necessarily a good thing, just for continuity and tension and stuff like that. But it's hard to resist when you've been doing one thing over and over again, to not jump into, you know, just, I'm just going to do a little tiny bit of this other thing just to break the monotony.
Right. Well, I think, you know, you have to do that to keep your sanity sometimes, especially if it's a large project. I kind of look at it as like, if I finish a good portion of the border, then I reward myself by letting myself stitch a little motif or something fun, you know, just to kind of break, like you said, the monotony of it all. So, you asked if I do stitch my own models, and
yes.
I do it for several reasons, mostly because, I do hopefully catch any mistakes that I've made in the chart. Not all the time. There's still some that, you know, get by me, but for the most part, I'm able to correct things as I go. And I often change colors too, as I'm stitching along. If something just doesn't look right, you know, it's easy for me to just go and find something to replace it with, rather than, you know, sending it to a model stitcher or, you know, going back and forth. I'm very hands-on, and I like to just see it come to life, you know, while I'm doing it, instead of through a photo or, you know, something like that. So
I assume that that also, by doing it yourself, you end up with better instructions, and over the, as with each one, your charting gets better, and your tips and hints get better as you go along, so that you're now what you're producing compared to when you began is significantly different?
I think it's also always helpful if you're the actual person putting something together, or, you know, making it. You know what has gone into it, and I do think it's helpful to do the directions or the chart, because you're actually right there in the process. So that's my main reason for doing them myself, I guess. So, and I enjoy the bringing them back to life. I really get a kick out of, you know, sitting down with a clean, you know, piece of linen and just starting. And it's like, you know, bringing something old like that back to life is just a real thrill for me.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that process.
Well, that's the one dimension of stitching that reproduction samplers have is bringing that history back. It's, mm-hmm. Over anything else. Yeah, it's pretty neat stuff. Do you tend to buy large samplers, small samplers, whatever strikes you?
Well, I have a little of both. Most of mine are fairly good size. I've kind of started looking for smaller samplers because I'm running out of wall space. So, so I mean, I do have to look at something sometimes and think, okay, now where would I hang that if it's already framed, or if I, you know, would want to frame it. Some of mine I have unframed just in storage. That, you know, it's fine. Some I will eventually frame and some I probably won't. But I am drawn to little samplers. I like stitching things very small myself. I love to stitch over one on 28 count, 30 count. I don't even mind stitching over one on 40 count. I know a lot of people are going to go, oh, but I don't mind doing that. Actually, my new favorite linen is 46 count from Lakeside. That is just, I just love stitching on it. I don't find it hard to see at all. And it just gives a nice kind of dense look to your motifs. And I don't know, I really enjoy, you know, using that size of a linen. So.
What do you think it is about the Lakeside that makes it easy to see? Because 46 is pretty... You know, tiny.
Well, as far as I know, she's the only one that is dyeing that high of count of linen. So, I mean, there may be other people out there that other manufacturers, but I don't know. It's just a nice, the weave isn't as tight. I used to stitch on 45 count and I enjoyed that too, but this new 46, even though it's just one more thread, I don't know, for some reason the weave is just a tad bit looser, and I just don't find it hard to see once you get going, you know, to see the weave at all to it. So I love it. I've been stitching most of my models in the last year on 46 count. And, well, and for one thing, it makes them smaller. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a little easier to travel with them to market. If they're smaller, or to send them to a trunk show or something like that, you know, there's quite a bit difference in the size from like a 30 count or 32 count down to a 46 count. I mean, it really definitely reduces the size of the, you know, of the sampler. So that's kind of what I've been starting to do.
Christine and I have talked a lot about stitching infrastructure. What's your infrastructure like? Do you have a room where you do all of your stitching? You stitch wherever in the house? How does that work in your home?
Well, we just built a new house last year, and actually I'm very fortunate. My husband really indulged me in letting me have my absolute dream craft room or studio or whatever you want to call it. And that is just where I go and shut the doors and just can, you know, be in my own little world. That's where all the work takes place, the charting, my supplies are all in there. You know, my inspiration is hanging with my samplers, but I don't find myself stitching as much in there. I have a big work table and the dogs are always asleep at my feet underneath. you know, that's where I put together charts. And sometimes if I have friends over, we sit in there and stitch. But mostly I stitch just in a little chair in the living room, you know, watching TV, usually with, you know, one dog beside me and another dog at my feet. I'm dog hair stitched in everything I've ever stitched, I'm sure. But you know, I could stitch anywhere. I can stitch on a plane. I can stitch in the car. I can stitch. I love to stitch on the patio. That's probably my favorite place. And living in Arizona, we're just coming upon, you know, our nice weather. So I can stitch out there and just, you know, really enjoy it.
Yeah,
and I like to stitch when football's on.
Oh, there you go. See, there it is right there.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
My favorite thing to do is stitch when
football's
on. You just
said exactly right.
That's right.
So
Sunday afternoon. Yeah, exactly.
You bet.
Mm-hmm. Just keep rolling the games. I'm there.
Yeah, you don't have to watch. You just get the, you know, you sit and listen, and you can look up once in a while if you, you know, get something going. And I don't know. That's my favorite background to stitching right there is football, for sure.
Yep. Yeah, whoever designed that game knew what they were doing. Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, and that stitching outdoors in Arizona, the times that we've been out there, when we've been out there when it isn't 110 degrees every day, no bugs, because here in Illinois, you know, to sit outside and stitch, you're swatting mosquitoes more than you're doing anything. And to just sit outside in that nice, pleasant air and it's so nice. But then when it's 110, that's a little tough to take.
I'm from Illinois.
Oh, you are?
I'm from Moline. But I've lived in Arizona now just 30 years. And I don't miss the mosquitoes or the bugs or the cold or any of that. I love Arizona, and we have wonderful weather to stitch outside, you know, for the most part. Yeah, I don't stitch out when it's 110 or, well, even when it's 100, I'm not going out there to do it. But for the most part, it's just ideal.
Yep.
So.
Yep. So nice. So, all right. So we need to, we're going to run out of time, but we need to talk about your own designs. So then you do samplers, but then you have a whole rack of your own things that you design. How does that come about? Is that just from your art background?
Well, no, I don't. Some designers that I know sketch, and then they'll sketch an idea out, and then they'll go to the computer and design it. I've never done that. I design kind of on a whim. I have ideas in my head. I make up little ditties and verses usually when I walk. I walk every day, and I come up with different ideas. And sometimes I just come home and sit at the computer and, you know, just start. I just sit down and start charting right at the computer without sketching it out or anything. And I don't know how I come up with my ideas. I guess it's just I'm inspired by the things that I have here in my home and the things that I love. Like antique coverlets has kind of been a big theme of mine. I've done several designs that, you know, coverlet houses, coverlet birds, coverlet Christmas. I've really kind of gotten carried away on the coverlets. But there's just something about the design element that I really am attracted to. And, you know, and the other things are like pottery, and I just like old things, but I think all my work kind of has a sampler style to it. So obviously I'm influenced by the samplers as well, but, I just, you know, and sometimes I like to do weird little things like Death by Candy Corn, I think was my second design. I just thought that was the funniest saying. I had seen it somewhere, and I don't know, I just thought, well, that would be kind of cute stitched up. And believe it or not, I came out with it 6.5 years ago, and I still am selling it. So I guess other people find it as oddly humorous as I do.
Yeah, I have to say that that one seems to be very popular.
Well, it's just, I like plays on words. You know, I have a little design called Queen of Quite a Lot. I thought that was kind of funny because I kind of feel like I am kind of queen of quite a lot in my own little world, you know, like most of us are. So I don't know. I like to do a variety of things. Whatever the mood strikes me, really, you know, inspires me, I guess, at the moment. So.
Always jealous of artists who can just do that. Just things come out of your head and become things.
Yeah.
Well, I it's not easy for me. Honestly, designing is very hard for me. To come up with original design. I have some designer friends that I swear they just are amazing. They come up with these designs all the time. I really have to work at it. You know, but I'm getting, I guess it's a little bit more comfortable with it. I'm trying to, you know, find my own style. I think that was the hardest thing. You know, you know what you like, and you know whose other designs you like to stitch, but you definitely, you know, you don't want to copy anyone, or, you know, you want to have your own unique style, and that's what I'm trying to accomplish, I think.
Well, and you have to balance what you like with what you think other people will like to stitch, because it's all well and good to design something that you like, but if no one else is going to like it enough to buy it, that's not a viable product, right? So you have to get that balance, which sometimes I imagine is difficult to do.
Well, honestly, this is the 100% truth. I really do design just for myself. I always have done that. I just feel like if I please myself first and design and stitch what I really want to do, then it'll always be fun. And hopefully somebody else out there will like it. But I just feel like, you know, I'm in this to design for myself, and I don't know, maybe that's not the right way to look at it, but that's just always been my approach. I could never just design something with the intent of seeing how well it would sell, and hate every minute of the design. You know, I have to enjoy the whole process. So I do design things that I would like to stitch and have, you know, either on display at my own house, or, you know, just enjoy the stitching part of it. So that's what I do.
Well, that gives you that's your long-term enjoyment. You know, if you take that approach, then it never gets old for you, because
exactly.
If you're always, you know, if you're always doing, well, this will sell, then pretty soon it just, wears you right down. Constant pressure to deliver the next big hit. So, yeah.
Well, exactly. And you just can't please everyone. So you might as well just try to please yourself. And, you know, hopefully you please a few others along the way. Yeah. So
do you do the one show a year? Is it one show that you target? And do you try to get as many designs ready for that as possible? Is that kind of a focal point for you?
Well, the Nashville market, I started designing 6.5 years ago, but didn't go to my first market until, I don't know, a couple of years after I started designing. So I've been to 3 markets. This will be my 4th one. And it's so much fun. It's a lot of work, a lot of preparation, you know, leading up to it, trying to figure out how many designs to do, how many charts to take. And of course, being in Arizona, you know, I have to ship everything to Nashville, like, you know, all the other designers here do. And so it's just a lot of logistics, figuring out what to do. But I typically try to have 6 or 7 new designs ready for market. And it's been real successful for me. And I've really enjoyed going and meeting the shop owners and meeting the other designers. It's just a lot of fun. There's a lot of camaraderie, you know, being with other like-minded people. It's just, I can't explain it. It's just something I wish everybody could experience, because it's just, I don't know, it's just a great experience.
Is that
once you get there?
Yeah, exactly. is that one of those shows where you have a hotel suite or a big room and kind of set up, and then people come and they literally buy your stuff on the spot and walk out? That's how it works?
Yes, it's a cash and carry. You know, we literally take over the entire hotel, and you know, the designers all have, or vendors all have their own room and suite, and, you know, you have your sleeping quarters in the back, and then your models and whatnot are all set up in the front. And it's just, there's five floors of us that do it. And
oh, that's got to be a riot.
It's fun. It's fun. And the shops just, you know, they hit the floor running, and, you know, they're in and out and on to the next, and they have their lists, and they, you know, sometimes they pre-order, which is always helpful, because, you know, then you get an idea of how many to, you know, that you might need. I don't know. It's just a lot of fun. You're absolutely exhausted, dead tired, but in a good way. So I really look forward to it once I'm there too.
That seems like a lot of fun. Plus you haul haul a bunch of stuff there, and you don't haul it home. So that's always good.
That's a good one. That's a good show.
That's the way you want to always have it work out. Definitely. Ship it there, but don't bring it back.
Yep. What's a typical day for you? Is designing and stitching almost like a full-time job for you, or how do you go through your days to do this business?
Well, it is a full-time job. I think I work harder, you know, than I've ever worked at any full-time job at it, because I literally live it. If I'm not thinking about designing, I'm designing or stitching or doing the, you know, processing orders or putting the charts together. I mean, it's my daily job. 7 days a week, I work at it, and it, because it's just, you know, I don't really look at it as a job. It's just such a big part of who I am that I, you know, when I wake up in the morning, I'm after a, you know, coffee, of course, and a walk outside. I just kind of hit the floor running, and I'm excited to see what, you know, what needs to be done that day and just go about it. It's a big part of my day is all revolves around designing. I probably spend about, on average, 4 to 5 hours a day stitching. So, you know, it's just kind of like breathing. It's just such a natural part of what I do. But that's my typical day. Although I do force myself to go bowling one day a week just to kind of get a break. But then I'm still looking at my phone. Still, you know, if there are any orders, still kind of thinking about it. So I try to get away from it, but I don't always do that.
I think I could tolerate that every day. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Putting together charts sometimes gets a little tedious, but you know, it's all part of the job. You know, I don't have anybody to help me. I've bribed my granddaughter a couple times and paid her off to put together charts, but that doesn't happen too often because she's pretty busy with school. But so I'm kind of like the one woman show here, and I can't get the dogs to do anything. So, so I have to do it all.
We need to get dogs opposable thumbs so they can help out with these things. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what we always say. You could help if you had thumbs, but they just lay around and watch.
Yeah. Well, so, you have company that way anyway. So,
exactly. I do.
Yep.
So,
Tanya, this has been fun. Boy, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, so it's been my pleasure. I love to talk about this crazy, passionate hobby that we have.
Mm-hmm. It's always another fun. Another reason to get down to the attic. So.
Oh, it's a must do if you know, for any stitcher. I mean, all needlework shops are fun to go to. But the attic, you know, is truly special if you're into samplers, especially.
Yeah, especially that.
Yeah, especially. Yeah. And they do carry, you know, they carry every, you know, there's such a variety of linens and threads, and if you can't find it there, you know, there's a good chance you're not going to find it anywhere. So it's just great for people to, you know, to go check it out.
Yep. We're going to have to send a bill for promotion to Jean. I think there's a,
I know. Yeah. Exactly.
Just occurred to me. Yeah, I think an invoice is going out right after this show. Yes.
Well, there are a lot of great shops, and I hope people do support their local shop, because it's such an important part of our industry. I mean, I would just be lost if I couldn't walk into the shop and, you know, see linen in person or choose, you know, I mean, I know what certain colors are, but there's just nothing like fondling the linen and, you know, looking at all the charts. And it's just a wonderful thing to be able to have it right there in person.
That's going to be it. Tanya, thank you so much. And thanks to everybody for listening. And Christine and I will be back Wednesday.